Today is Thursday, May the 9th, 2019. We're going to hear Reb Moshe Soloveitchik Shir on Yom Hatzma'ot.
I hope no one is unhappy with this, but I requested of Rabbi Soloveitchik to speak tonight about Yom Hatzma'ot, Israel Independence Day. And I feel after the 71 years, Bli Ayin Hara, we've become used to the idea of having a state of Israel. But events that have occurred recently, and always have occurred, but underlined recently, show us that we have to have tremendous gratitude for the fact that there is a state of Israel, that the Jews have a place to go, as always an open invitation for every Jew, and they accommodate every Jew. And that is something which has not existed in 2,000 years. And it's something for us to be very grateful of. And so therefore, in observance and celebration of Yom Ha'atzmaut, I ask Rabbi Soloveitchik to please address this.
There's no class next Thursday, but the Thursday afterwards there is.
Everybody heard, no class next Thursday. We'll be meeting in 2 weeks.
Lag BaOmer. Yeah. All right. First of all, I want to mention the class is dedicated in memory of Frank Borg. Brian Ben Moshe was a very close friend of mine, and was a member of my shul, Mrs. Leonard's brother. When he died, it happened to be Yom Ha'atzmaut, and Yom Ha'atzmaut is a time that I usually have a certain degree of joy and happiness. And but it's also his yard site, and it's for me personally, that day is both it's joy about the state of Israel, but there is a personal touch of sadness when I remember Frank, and he died at such a young age, and it was a very, very nice person, extremely nice person. Also, we had a special minyan today for Mincha in memory of Mrs. Fagan. It should be an aliyah for her neshama. And as Rabbi Berger mentioned, I'm going to speak about Yom Ha'atzmaut. Not so much about Yom Ha'atzmaut. I have spoken here on occasion about the ritual, whether to say Hallel, not to say Hallel, whether to say Tachanun, not to say Tachanun. I have spoken in the past about that. I want to speak about, there is a certain Gemara that in the end of Maseches Ksuvos, the end of Maseches Ksuvos, that has been the ideological source for the conflicting opinions regarding the establishment of the state in the Frum community, in the Orthodox community. There's a very, and this to a certain regard, whether that's the real reason or it's not the real reason, let's say the Satmar Chassidim, who somewhat opposed to the state of Israel, who were somewhat opposed, they base it on this Gemara. And I want to discuss this Gemara. The Gemara says that God made the Jewish people take three oaths. And it's some they mention other oaths also, but three main oaths. One oath is not to rebel against the nations of the world. That's one oath. The second oath is Shelo Yalu Bechoma. Now you can't think in contemporary terms, you have to think like they thought 2,000 years ago. When you waged war, you had to climb over the wall of the city to wage war. So, shelo yalu b'choma, that you should not make an invasion of Eretz Yisrael, and that's the second oath. And then the third oath, which was not imposed on the Jewish people, but was imposed on the nations of the world, was that shlo yishtabdu es Yisrael yosem midai. They should not oppress the Jewish nation too much. Well, it's apparently a little was tolerated, but they should not oppress the Jewish people too much. I guess that the guy was realistic about what goes on. Anyway, this was the Gemara that the Satmar Rebbe mentioned as his, because he was opposed and until his last day was opposed to the idea of a state of Israel until the time Mashiach comes. And he mentioned this, there was a Shelo Yalu B'choma, we're not allowed to go and conquer Eretz Yisrael until Mashiach comes or until a Navi comes and tells us to learn Vitumim, whatever it might be. There are all kinds of ways of understanding it. Now, and then there were those who had a certain opinion, let's say Rav Henkin, for example, and someone told me, but I never saw it inside, so I'm somewhat skeptical about it. Not that I have any reason to be skeptical, just that unless I see it inside, I don't assume that it's true, that the Lubavitcher Rebbe also originally had that opinion. In other words, Rav Henkin was opposed to the war of independence, so to say. But he says, once the state of Israel was established, then we have to give it our utmost support. In other words, it was to start a revolt, to fight for it, that's one thing. But once it was established, on the contrary, he gave it his strongest support. And there was someone who told me that that was the opinion of the Lubavitcher Rebbe also. I don't know. But this obviously was not the impression that the perspective that my father had, and I don't think that my uncle had that perspective either, although I can't say that I ever discussed it with him. But it's clear from the things that he said that he, although in a much more limited way than my father, that he did not have that perspective. And my father suggested a very interesting explanation, which, by the way, was repeated to my father's uncle, the Brisker Rav, who was fiercely anti-Zionist, against the establishment of the state. It's interesting, in our family, those that are anti-Zionist live in Israel, and those that are pro-Zionist live outside of Israel. But okay, so, whatever it is, so my father suggests that he said there is a halacha brought down two parties make an oath together. This one will do this, or it won't do, and this one will do. And the oaths are made one dependent upon the other. So if one violates his oath, the other one is relieved from his oath. So my father said, well, we have three oaths here. Two were imposed on the Jewish people, not to revolt against the nations of the world, and not to invade the land of Israel. But one oath was imposed upon the nations of the world not to harass the Jewish people too much. So my father said, from both perspectives, one hand, this is shortly after the Holocaust, and there were those that did, and there were those who didn't do. And certainly the Arabs under the leadership of the Mufti in Israel, take the Hebron massacre of 1929, where they went in and slaughtered men, women, and children, rabbinical students who'd never held a gun in their lives, were slaughtered. And they were pacifists, the ones that were slaughtered. When the Yishuv offered that they would send soldiers there to guard them, they said, no, we want to keep peace, we don't want anybody there. So, and they certainly did not pose a threat to the Jewish people, and they were very friendly up till that point with the Arabs who lived in Hebron. So so they certainly, if we take literally that God imposed an oath upon them, they certainly were in violation. They were certainly in violation of their oath, and so. My father felt so the Jewish people were then relieved of their responsibility. So then, one of my father's uncle's talmidim that lived in New York at the time, but would go to Eretz Yisrael from time to time to talk with the Brisker Rav, who was his rebbe. So he told the Brisker Rav, he says, your nephew said such and such. So the Brisker Rav said, I don't know if my nephew, he didn't say that my father was wrong, but he just said, I don't know if my nephew was right that the two oaths were made one dependent upon the other. It might have been, actually my father took the mild response of his uncle to what he said as proof that he was right. Okay, so that this was the response to Brisker, and my father, by the way, with that answered, it wasn't just a hashkafishir, although he said it in a hashkafishir. He used it to explain many shitos in halacha, but I'm not going to get into it. He used it to explain some very difficult rambams. But there was an answer which I thought was a very, very good answer by Rav Chaim Zimmerman, who was an outstanding genius, is I guess the best way to put it, an outstanding Talmud Chacham, Goen, whatever, who lived, by the way, in Chicago for a period of time. And he had been a student of my grandfather in the 30s. And he suggested, but he didn't explain why it's that way, and I want to perhaps explain his answer. Now, I don't know that he would agree with what I'm saying, but because of what he said, I was able, that sort of say gave me a certain avenue to try to understand this halacha. He said the expression shelo yalu b'choma indicates that what was God opposed to? God was opposed to the Jewish people forming, let's say, an army in Turkey, let's say, outside the land of Israel, and then taking that army to invade the land of Israel. And the expression, Shelo Yalu Bechoma, they shouldn't climb up over the walls, does give that impression. But more than that, he mentions that, I think it's in the Medrash Rabbah of Shir HaShirim, they add two words. Shelo Yalu Bechoma Min HaChutz. They shouldn't rise up over the wall from outside. The same expression, just with those two words. So he said, to invade, they were not allowed to raise an army outside Israel and then go to invade the country, from the outside. But if they establish a community within Israel, and then they raise an army, and in order to take control of the land, that would be permitted. That's what he said. Now, he showed different proofs for it, because he mentions, it says, V'yirashtem v'yishavtem bo, you shall conquer the land and settle in it. But in one pasuk in Tehillim, it puts it in the reverse order. It mentions the Yishavtem, you shall dwell therein, the Yerashtem also, and you shall conquer it. So he says, originally, when the Jews first entered the land of Israel, under Joshua, they went in and conquered and then settled. He says, but in the future, it'll start with settling and then conquering. That's how he explained it. Now, I wanted to understand this answer. And again, the explanation I'm going to give might not be what he had in mind, but I nevertheless feel that it might be true. According to the way the Rambam paskins, there is a dispute about it, but, you know, the land of Israel is sanctified for mitzvos. Let's say the law is that things that grow in the land of Israel, agricultural products, fruit, whatever, even vegetables, the different opinions as to what's biblical, what's rabbinic, but things that grow in the land, we have to take off trumos and maestros. Trumos was from your crop, you took off a small amount that was given to the Kohen, and maestros. So there's different forms of maestros. One type of maeser was given to the Levi. A tenth of the produce was given to the Levi. And then there was maeser ani in certain years that you had to take a tenth to give to the poor people. So but these laws do not apply. Do not apply to your garden in Northbrook. These laws only apply in Eretz Yisrael. Why? Because Eretz Yisrael is sanctified. Now, the land of Israel was sanctified twice. First time it was sanctified was by Joshua, by Yoshua. When Yoshua came to Eretz Yisrael, and he initiated the first commonwealth through conquest, he conquered the land from the Canaanites. He thereby sanctified the land. And because of that, until Nebuchadnezzar sent the Jews into Babylonian exile, the land of Israel had this special sanctity requiring that affected the produce that was growing on the land. Then when Ezra came up at the Second Commonwealth, he re-sanctified the land. But what was interesting is, when Joshua sanctified the land, when Yahushua sanctified the land, that sanctification came to an end at the end of the first temple period. when the Jews went into their first exile, the Babylonian exile. However, the sanctification that was endowed or given over to the land by Ezra when he built the second temple, when he went up at the beginning of the second commonwealth, that dusha, that sanctification remained even after the Jewish people went into Roman exile. And that sanctification, the Gemara tells us, kitsha l'shaita v'kitsha l'asad lavo. It was sanctified for its time, and it was sanctified forever. And the question is, I would have thought the very reverse. I would have thought that Yehoshua, the student of Moshe Rabbeinu, who went in with all kinds of miracles, that his sanctification would be at least as strong as the sanctification of Ezra, who went up with the permission of the governments, and we see the very reverse is true. And the Rambam asks that question, and the Rambam says that the first sanctification was through occupation, through war, through conquest. The sanctification, and it was conquest that was permitted and allowed by God. Yeshua, first of all, Yeshua himself was a prophet. Secondly, he checked with the Urim V'Tumim that the Kohen Gadol, that the Kohen wore on, that they received heavenly messages through the lighting up of the letters. So that was done with the approval of God. Nevertheless, the sanctity that came by conquest ended when the conquest ended. However, he says the sanctification that was given by Ezra, that wasn't through conquest. Ezra did not go up with an army. Ezra went up and settled the land. He settled the land. He calls that chazaka. What is chazaka? Chazaka is a demonstration of ownership. It's a demonstration of ownership. Chazaka, if you acquire a house through chazaka, you lock the door of the house. You demonstrate ownership. You demonstrate ownership on your field by working on the field. It was a demonstration of ownership. Ezra didn't go up with an army. They had to protect themselves. There were people that tried to hinder their efforts to rebuild the Beis Hamikdash. But there was no conquest at that time. So that sanctity, he says, since it was through Chazaka, was a permanent sanctity. The question is, why is it that way? And I think we could suggest, you know, at one time, they say that the sun never set on the British Empire. India. It's one time in the United States. But one thing I can assure you, all the British officers that were in India and the British officers that were in the United States or the colonies or whatever it was, they didn't consider it Britain. They considered it to be British occupied territory. In other words, that's the difference between conquest and chazaka. Conquest is a demonstration of occupation. It's a demonstration of control. But it's not identification. Now, there's no doubt that the land of Israel belonged to the Jewish people from the time of Abraham. God told Abraham, traverse the land. The land is yours and it's for your descendants after you. But nevertheless, when the Jewish people went in to claim their land, they had to do it by, in the time of Joshua, they had to do it through the use of an army, through an occupation. So that act was not a demonstration of identification. That was a demonstration of control. But when the Jewish people went up from Babylonia initially, and when they went up from Babylonia, Persia, wherever it was, and they started working on the land, and they started building houses on the land, that was a demonstration, this is our land. It wasn't so much a demonstration of control, of course there was control, as that was a personal identification. And I think that, now it's true, after the war that Joshua had, they built houses, they worked the land. But working the land that comes after conquest, in a certain sense, is the continuation of the conquest. The people from England that went to India and built businesses there and all that, and acquired property there, that was all just the continuation of the conquest of India by the English. But it did not turn India into England. So, the Dusha, now occupation, conquest is only temporary. Something that is done by force, not just when it comes to sanctification of the land, when it comes to teaching. Sometimes you have to use force. But when the teacher is away, we know what happens. But when you inspire a student, when you work with the student, and it isn't by the ruler in the hand, then even when the teacher is away, the student continues to act in the way he did when the teacher was there. So that's the nature of control, of conquest. So I think, but when there's identification shows permanence, especially when it's a return. The Jews were forced to leave Israel. They were forced to go to Babylonia, and then they came up and started working on the land. That was a demonstration of identification. I think this is so that shows permanence. When it shows permanence, so that dusha, the sanctification that comes from that act, which shows identification with the land, that shows a permanent relationship. It's a demonstration of a permanent relationship. So the sanctification that comes from that is permanent also. And I think, when we think about, we could suggest, and I think this is very relevant to the way the State of Israel was founded. If you organize an army from outside the land, that's a demonstration of occupation. That's a demonstration it's like an attack by outsiders. You don't show that the land of Israel is really your land. It's not a demonstration that it's your land. It's a demonstration that you want control of the land. But when you come up especially after a period of 2,000 years, let it be 600 years, let it be 2,000 years, and you return and you start working on the land. That shows an identification between the people and the land. And that shows permanence. That shows permanence. So the God wanted that the relationship that the Jews would have with the land of Israel shouldn't be just one of control, but it should be identification with the land. So God bade them take an oath. Shelo yalu bechomei mibachutz, do not raise an army from outside, but from the inside, when you come and you live in the land first, then you show identification. You're fighting for what's yours. And why is it ours? When we went there and started working, that's not what made it ours. That just showed that we had the feelings it's ours. But why was it ours? It was ours because we inherited from our ancestors, from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And in a certain sense, we have to realize that if we do not value the linkage of the generations, then we lose our rights to the land of Israel. Why is it that every time there's an archaeological discovery on the Temple Mount, the Arab countries, the Muslims in charge, they destroy it right away? It's well known that if there is an archaeological discovery that showed Jewish presence, they destroy it right away. Because they know that our right, the permanence, our right to the land of Israel emanates from the fact that it belonged to our ancestors. Because that's the identification with the land. They want us to see, they want the world to recognize the Jewish presence in Eretz Yisrael as occupation. It's not just occupation. It's because we are identified with the land because of the connection that the land had with our ancestors. And I want to add a point. There's no question that many of the original settlers, even before the Zionist movement started, when you had the Bilui, Beis Yaakov, Lechuven Elcha, many of them were not religious, were not observant. Some were even anti-religious. But we have to say, what made them, okay, leaving Russia, we could understand, there were pogroms, but what made them wanted to go to the land of Israel, a land of swamps, malaria? What did that show? That showed that they identified with the land. At that time, they didn't even have control. They had to work, and they didn't have the advanced equipment that we have today. It was an identification. That showed that even though they tried to make believe, they were not part of the chain of generations that connected them to past generations. They really, deep down inside, even if they didn't realize it, they were part of that tradition, because they had no reason to try to go to work on swamps and turn Israel into the land that it is today. So what I think, the Yom HaTzmaut, it's the day the State of Israel is proclaimed. But it was, you have to understand, it wasn't occupation. It was an identification with the land that was given to our ancestors. And if we try to deny the Mesorah, those who try to deny the Mesorah, they have to realize They're denying the Jewish identification of the land of Israel.
We dive in about 3 minutes. Remember, no class next Thursday. We'll meet in 2 weeks.